Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Everyday Anarchism. I am your host, Graham Culbertson, and my guest today is Andrea Chalupa. Just so you know, we're not recording video. I publish only
I'm gonna still make gestures so, anyway.
But, I mean, be as excited as you want to be. I just want to make sure that your gestures will be wasted on the audience. Only I will receive the gestures.
You.
Yes, and I don't consider it a waste. So we are here to talk about your new graphic novel, and I should say it's half yours. There is an artist who's not with us, and the art is wonderful. But I need to acknowledge the collaborator,
Bram Revell. He's extraordinary,
stunning work. And this book is called Mrs. Orwell. And let me do a little introduction, and then I'll unleash you, because you know George Orwell is, I think, for most people on the left, but especially for anyone with anarchist sensibilities, I mean, basically anyone except for the Stalinists is a hero. His works are fantastic. I mean, yes, he's been appropriated by the right, and you know, everyone likes to talk about Big Brother, but that's okay. We can all hate totalitarianism together. His books are wonderful. In particular, this book, Homage to Catalonia, is incredibly important to anarchists. And I've seen cropping up lately, as someone who is certainly no expert on Orwell and knew very little about his life, that he had a highly important collaborator who had been left out of his story. And as soon as I saw that, I thought, I mean, I should say, you know, Orwell is a fictional character, is a pen name. Eric Blair is the name of the actual writer. And so as soon as I saw your book, Mrs. Orwell, which is not Mrs. Orwell because she's just a Mrs., but because Orwell was two people, a writer and an editor, I knew that I had to have you on the show to unpack this. And I have to say, I mean, again, the art is stunning. The story is stunning. It's beautiful. I devoured this thing. I recommend it to the listeners. I've already given the copy over to my wife to read. It's a fantastic accomplishment. So before I say anything else, thank you for writing this book and telling the story. It was amazing.
Oh my gosh. Thank you so much for that incredible introduction. And I hope your wife enjoys it as well. I am so grateful to George Orwell for giving me and all of us a language to battle the fascism and to find and awaken our own inner anarchists. And because the Orwells, the Blairs, I should say, were fierce believers in people power, in grassroots power, in self-organization, as my graphic novel, Mrs. Orwell, shows. And I'm so grateful to Orwell because through him, I discovered his wife, who's remarkable. And I, like you said in your introduction, Orwell has been co-opted across the political spectrum, especially by bad actors that abuse him. I've been on Elon Musk's X and seen all these super manly alpha males quoting Orwell. And I just think to myself, and I've clapped back at them from time to time. I've just said, like, do you understand that George Orwell is the product of some extraordinarily fearless, tenacious women? And I think that's important for all of us, especially in this moment in time, to humanize Orwell, to remove the iconography, the sainthood, and to remind ourselves what a fragile, deeply insecure human being he was. And that's why Eileen, his wife, was so important to him, because all the reports of their friends observing their marriage, their partnership over the years, kept saying is that Eileen kept him up. She was just unbridled enthusiasm, energy, defiance, creativity, childlike wonder, a pure soul, pure heart. And they were kindred spirits in that way. But she had a fierceness to her that I don't want to say he lacked, but I'll put it to you this way. We know from Orwell's essay, Why I Write, and we know from his other writings that he ran from himself. Like a lot of sort of creatives, I had that. Like it took me a while. I'm sort of a late bloomer to finally say, you know, I'm a writer, I've got to just do this. Orwell ran from himself. He went into the British Imperial Police. He was a fascist. He tells us all these stories in Burmese days, right? In Shooting an Elephant. And Meanwhile, his wife was this badass revolutionary. She was among the earliest women to graduate from Oxford. She graduated in 1927, the same year when Oxford was like, all right, enough already. We're going to put a strict quota on women. We're going to allow to graduate. You know, they're pumping the brakes on this. And she studied under J.R.R. Tolkien, who used his own trauma of the Great War, fighting in the Great War, like the unimaginable millions of bodies and horse carcasses scattered across Europe, just like the, you know, the mouth of hell opened across Europe in the Great War. And Tolkien turned that trauma, the loss of some of his closest friends, into great art in beginning what would become, you know, the Middle Earth and all the Lord of the Rings and all that. And she studied under him and went up against him. And then she would in turn take the trauma that she and Orwell would go through, fighting fascists in the Spanish Civil War, living in London deliberately, choosing to live in London during the Blitz out of solidarity. And she took all that and composted it with her husband into great art, into Animal Farm, into inspiring ideas that would eventually make it into 1984. And one of the things that she did was she embraced this early field of child psychology. And Orwell's breakout novel was a children's book, Animal Farm. And that's significant because if you study Orwell's writings, he's especially his early novels, he's always talking directly to the camera. He's like, let me tell you what I think about this. And I can tell you, being a historian, being a journalist who then had to transition into creative writing, it's extremely hard to turn off the journalist. It's extremely hard. Creative writing is its own beast. Taking poetic license in a work after you've been trained to fact check religiously is painful. And Orwell was like the ultimate, like he saw himself as a pamphleteer. He just wanted to make statements. And Eileen comes in with her Tolkien education at Oxford and her child psychology. And she's gently finessing him and saying, you know, and you see it. You see it in the psychology, the sensitivity of Animal Farm. And if you compare the before and after, even their own friends said that when Eileen came along, Orwell's creative writing deepened. And her descendants even credit her with straight up writing Animal Farm. And when I was in the Orwell archives in London, like right after Brexit, I was there for 2 weeks casting for my film, Mr. Jones, which Orwell's in as a character. It's about, it stars James Norton and Vanessa Kirby. It's about Stalin's genocide famine in Ukraine. I was looking at the Orwell archives, like touching their documents, their diaries, the paper and all of that. And I came across a letter of a friend who had just visited the Blairs and said, you know, I had dinner with Eric and Eileen, and Eric was George Orwell's real name. Eric was mumbling something about some book about animals. It sounded horrible, but Eileen was so excited. She's like, this is the one, this is the one. And she was right. Animal Farm was the book that finally made him rich and famous. And that was Eileen's driving force. And just to understand like why he got caught up with her. Like, you know, Orwell was a hot hipster brooding guy that the girls threw him, like he had all these lovers, like girls were throwing themselves on him. His friends couldn't understand it. And the reason why he chose Eileen and Eileen chose him was because they had instant kinship. They had this instant electrical connection. Like the night they met at a party at his house, she was friends with his, Eileen came into Orwell's life in a child psychology class with Orwell's roommate, this woman named Rosalind. And Rosalind and Eric Blair were having a party, and Eileen was invited, and she was the life of the party, this Irish girl, just so charismatic, so fearless. And that night, Orwell said, that is the kind of girl I'd like to marry. And they had this whirlwind romance because their families were trying to stop them. Because the family, because in each of their respective families, Eileen and Eric were seen as sort of those black sheep, sort of like, oh, that's the whimsical artist of the family. We've got to protect them from them, from their worst instincts and society itself. They're sort of, you know, they were seen as that sort of troublemaker in their respective families, Orwell more so, certainly. And so they had to rush the aisle because their families were you know, very proper Victorian British families going, what is this? And so they had a whirlwind romance, and when they're getting married and as newlyweds, the war broke out in Spain, and they spent their honeymoon fighting fascists in the Spanish Civil War. And there's, of course, a whole section of that extraordinary taken from history moment in their lives where they're being hunted by Stalin's agents on the front lines. And Eileen literally saves her husband's life, smuggling them out of Spain. And that, and there would have been no George Orwell if it weren't for her. Like, she saved her husband's life, not just in Spain, but later when he was hemorrhaging blood, when he was having his lung issues, she called her brother, who was a doctor specialized in Orwell's exact condition by chance. And so I can't stress enough that the story of Eileen, her tenacity, her spirit, it's one that has helped me tremendously in confronting the times that we're in today.
Yeah, that's all fantastic. A couple things I want to say. I mean, first, you know, as listeners know, I've mostly not covered Homage de Catalonia much and the Spanish Civil War because I'm a little afraid in that there has been since that book was written, or at least since Orwell became famous, there is an entire scholarly apparatus arguing about how accurate it is to the wider picture of the Spanish Civil War. And someday I'm going to find a scholar who I truly trust to help me parse through it. But I haven't done that yet. Certainly, the anarchists come off great in that book, and Stalin is the villain, and that's really easy for me to believe. But I'll have to worry about that some other time. The one thing I did want to keep talking about, though, before we go further into the story, is just this question of the collaborator. I mean, it's so often it's a woman or a wife, the collaborator who is, you know, is 50% of the partnership or indeed even more, and just doesn't get mentioned. I learned only recently, and of course I've forgotten her name, that John Stuart Mill's famous essay on liberty was co-written with his wife, which I have like three copies of that book floating around somewhere, and it just says J.S. Mill on it. When I was a kid, I loved this mystery writer my mom got me hooked on named Dick Francis, and all of Dick Francis's books later in his life weren't very good because his wife died. And I don't know if she was 50% or 70%, but she was at least 50%, it turns out. But it just says Dick Francis on the cover. By the flip side, is there still people who can't believe that Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein? Percy Bysshe Shelley, great writer, great thinker, not as good of a writer or a thinker as Mary Shelley. But even though that book has her name on it, you'll still find people saying like, well, you know, it was Percy who wrote it. And I know this trend must continue, but it's also time for us to start calling bullshit on it and saying, no, we're not going to do this anymore. We're not going to put one person's name on a book, one man's name on a book, even if a woman co-wrote it. And we're not going to have a woman who wrote a book and was edited by her husband and insist that honestly, her name should be taken off entirely and his name should be substituted. This has got to stop. And your graphic novel, I think, is a great place to start.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, I think it's such an important reminder that Eric Blair was human and he needed a whole support system to do what he did and transform in the ways that he always wanted to in order to become an artist. He tells us in Why I Write, like, I have an ego, I want to be an artist. And it's like, well, that's hard. And here's this woman who's going to help you. And I guess part of it is also I'm jealous. Like, I love my husband dearly. He's my soulmate. And he reads my stuff and he gives me good notes in the sense that he's got such an amazing attention to detail with OCD for typos. But, you know, and he's always very like cheerleader supportive, which I do not take for granted in the slightest, of course. But with that said, if I had an editor who studied under Tolkien, who studied child psychology, who was helping me manuscript after manuscript and editing and shaping it and really being hands-on and protecting me from my worst creative instincts. So Animal Farm, for instance, it's believed it came out of an essay that Orwell wanted to write in frustration. Like, there's a lot of frustration that they're living through, a lot of censorship, a lot of rage against the machine. And so, you know, their experiences in Spain, that was their eyewitness account. Like, he had his diaries, he was tracking everything. They had their friends, their network there, and they could only come out and say what they lived, their lived experience. And as a primary source, that's undeniably valid. And they took a lot of great personal risk and professional risk in doing that, because coming out of that war, the prevailing orthodoxy was that Uncle Joe Stalin was our hero, the workers' hero. And what Orwell was blowing the lid off of was the fact that that Stalin's paranoid Moscow show trials were extending from Moscow into Spain. He had his terror squads in Spain. And in fact, the Orwells were tried in absentia, and they had friends who were disappeared, arrested, and so on. It was massively traumatic. They could have very well been killed in that. And Eileen herself was a bigger political prize for the Stalinists than Orwell, because she was working for the British Independent Labor Party in an office in Barcelona, which would have had lists of fighters, of names of foreign fighters coming from the UK and elsewhere that Stalin's agents would have loved to have gotten their hands on. And as you see in the graphic novel, when Orwell was out in the front fighting, Eileen was staying in the Hotel Continental in Barcelona, that's still there to this day, where Hemingway and Dos Passos and all of them stayed. And Orwell was there too. And Stalin's agents came and knocked on her door and searched the hotel room and took Orwell's papers and diaries that are believed to still be in Moscow to this day. And so they took what they lived through, the horror of it, and they put it in this book. And what I love about it is that they retreated to the English countryside, living as hipster doomsday preppers, preparing for the end of the world. Like Orwell was like, we're gonna have our food buried here. We're gonna get our grenades and our rifles. We're gonna prepare for the Nazis to invade, because when the fascists inevitably come, our police are gonna be on their side, which he was right, as we're seeing now in America with Trump. Like, he was right. The police will always be on the side of the fascists. And so, and they're doomsday hipster preppers living in this, you know, village. Like, they would have very much stood out to the local farmers, the locals in the pub. And they were nursing their wounds, like, you know, and working on, and Orwell very literally, because he was shot through the neck. And so they were working on their big Spain book, putting everything into their Spain book. And it barely sold many copies. And plus, he had to endure hit pieces. There was one report I came across where one of his friends from Spain was getting harassed at his home over disinformation campaigns attacking him for trying to speak out about what it was really like over there. Because there was such, you know, the ideology wars, like, we think our fights are bad now on social media. The ideology wars of the 1930s and 40s and so on, where people really took a side and were so fiercely tribal in that side, and you weren't allowed to step out of line. Orwell and Eileen dared to step out of line. They believed their eyes and ears. And so and in that frustration and going up against all of these powerful forces, including their own friends, including what was fashionable back then, they had to sort of bob and weave and find a way. And so Orwell wanted to write another essay saying, like, God damn it. Like, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, grabbing the reader by the collar. And Eileen was like, no. We need to find, you know, another way of doing this. And eventually that other way became Animal Farm. And of course, like, as anyone who's created a work of art knows, art is all collage. Like, he got ideas from watching a boy driving a horse cart and whipping the horse and thinking, if that horse only knew its power, it could crush that boy. And then, of course, he and Eileen were trying to make a go of it, living as farmers and raising chickens and goats and things. And so some of the animals make appearances in Animal Farm. And Eileen hated the farm. And so she'd come up with these dramatic stories about the animals. And of course, that drove the novel as well. And so for me, it's just such a beautiful, inspiring reminder for us today is to be tenacious. Be tenacious. Like, don't give up on yourself. Don't give up on your lived experience. Believe your eyes and ears, and believe in the power of your voice. And that is very much the spirit that Eileen brought to that partnership.
Yeah, I do. I do want to mention, since you mentioned this disinformation campaign, I mean, this ideological battle isn't over. I was in London recently and I found this, you know, really cool radical bookstore. I think it was called Bookmarks. It said it was a socialist bookstore. And so it has, you know, multiple shelves of labeled Marxism, zero shelves labeled anarchism. And I grabbed a book written by someone, a socialist writer about Orwell. And what I found, it was an enjoyable book, but basically it was a defense of Orwell. The whole book, it was like 100 pages just saying, it's okay to like Orwell. He's a good socialist, even though he was on the wrong side of the USSR debate. And I was like, wait, there's still people out there who are like, there's people who call themselves leftists or Marxists or socialists or whatever, who are just like, you know where things went wrong, that the wrong side won the Cold War. And if only, you know, Khrushchev or Brezhnev or Stalin had been in charge, the revolution would have come. It's hard for me to believe those people are out there, but they are out there. And
it's maddening. It is absolutely. They're the bane of my existence, the tankies. And they're called tankies because Khrushchev sent like 2,000 tanks to crush the Hungarian uprising that was student and worker led. And it's just, they're the leopards, you know, eating your face party or whatever. Like, that's who they are. Like, they just punch themselves in the face with their nonsense.
They are. And I mean, you know, I'm not a good enough historian to know why this happened, but my understanding is at least part of it is just like Marx was a really, really good at intra-party politics. And so every time the socialist groups got together, Marx like maneuvered the anarchists out of the picture. And so now Marxism and, you know, socialism are synonyms. I mean, there's this phrase anti-communist, which means hating Stalin, basically. And I'm like, well, I mean, you know, am I an anti-communist? Depends on what you mean by anti-communist. If you mean hating the tankies, then yes, sign me up.
Exactly. Exactly. Thank you. It's very dehumanizing, the labels that side throws around.
Yeah.
And I want like an entire, like, what was your childhood like? Who raised you? Like, what is inside your head like? Because it's fascinating how flat. It's like they're flat earthers, you know? Like, I'm as fascinated by them as I am flat earthers.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. So, I mean, there's a famous Orwell quote that's something like, you know, it's hard to see what's right in front of your face or something like that. And what that quote is about is ideology. Is if you've got a framework that tells you up is down and you're sure up is down, then everywhere you look, you're going to see up is down. That's just, you know, and yes, again, you know, the right wingers have appropriated a lot of the ways of thinking from 1984, but that doesn't make it wrong. Actually, let me ask you this. The book opens with a statement that Eileen is making about, you know, the pen being mightier than the sword. Is that, I couldn't tell, was that something she had written while she was in college, or did you write that in her?
Yeah, so she spirit? Had given, she had given, she went to a girls' school in England. And she had given, she was famous for giving these debates or giving these speeches. And she was so charismatic and did theater. And one of the speeches she gave was about the pen being mightier than the sword. And another one was, we cannot look away. We're morally obligated to confront the evils of the world. And that's very Orwellian. Like, meanwhile, Orwell wasn't eaten. And signing up to be an imperial policeman, like, you know, so that's what I mean. Like, she was more Orwell than Orwell. And I think the difference between them came from the fact that Eileen was half Irish and she was compared to a beloved uncle. They're seen as very similar. She had a journalist uncle who was in an Irish literary society, very active in London. And so she had a proud Irish lineage that she was connected to through her father. And I think, you know, obviously she had an Irish name, Eileen, Irish look to her. People described her as an Irish beauty, dark hair, cat-like face and features, and just life of the party, open-hearted Irish through and through. And we're recording this on St. Patrick's Day, so I feel yes. Very honored to have this conversation about Eileen O'Shaughnessy, as they would say in Ireland, Shaughnessy. Because that was her maiden name, it was Shaughnessy. O'Shaughnessy. And so Eileen O'Shaughnessy had that fiery, proudly rebellious, independent Irish spirit. And I think that is what made the difference, because Orwell was English, as we know from his pen name. Orwell after the English River and George after the king at the time. And he came from an English Victorian family, went to Eton, wetted the bed at Eton. It was sort of a hard place for a sensitive soul like him to be. And here comes proud, loud, loves to drink, loves to smoke, climb over the furniture of the party kind of energy, Eileen, who gives him a place to be safe, gives him a nest in the storm, and gives him all the enthusiasm and encouragement he, as a deeply insecure man who's probably a bit traumatized from a Victorian upbringing, needed, and believed in him, fiercely believed in him. She worked the jobs, the day jobs, to help him, to help support them, and so he could write. And she went along with the spirit of what they wanted to do. Like, sure, let's make a go at farming. Yes, of course, we're going to go to Spain. Like, they were kindred spirits. And they had a bit of an open marriage as part of that. Orwell could sleep pretty much with whoever he wanted. He would go after her friends from time to time. We don't know as much about that on her side. We don't think it really happened, except for dramatically, as you see in my graphic novel, when they landed in Spain, there was a charismatic commander in Orwell's battalion. This man, this mysterious figure by the name of George Kopp, who was larger than life, brilliant. And he was good. He, you know, adopted the Orwells right away. And it's believed very strongly that he fell in love with Eileen. We don't know if anything happened between George Kopp and Eileen in Spain, but we do know that Kopp was arrested, imprisoned as part of Stalin's witch hunts in Spain. And it took a while for him to get out finally. And when he rebuilt his life again, he spent it trying to stay as close to the Orwells as possible. He would go off and go on his own adventures. He fought in the French resistance for a time, but he would always come back and find the Orwells and stay close to them, and even married Eileen's sister-in-law. And so the belief is that there was something there between them, at least emotionally, an emotional affair. In fact, in 1984, Winston Smith's torturer, O'Brien, who pretends to be his friend as part of some underground resistance, and then, surprise, ends up becoming his torturer, O'Brien, that character, fits the physicality of George Kopp. And so the belief, and Orwell even had a quote that said he could tolerate physical affairs, but he drew the line on affairs of the heart. So discovering that Eileen had had some sort of something with George Kopp, some connection there, would have been crushing for him, given especially his sort of insecurity as well, his famous insecurity.
Yeah, no, that makes complete sense. In a piece I read on Orwell in the London Review of Books a couple years ago, is by Colin Burrow. He makes a big deal that Orwell, you know, Orwell tried to refuse ideology and just stand for decency, which I'm a huge fan of that formulation. That's, you know, David Graeber basically says that almost identically, and Kropotkin says things like this as well. We don't need a mathematical formula for what, you know, from each according to their ability and to each according to their needs means. We don't need bureaucracy. We just need to behave decently to one another, be neighborly, treat everyone well. The real problem with that, at least this is Colin Burrow's point, and I think this is true, historically, that's always been the rule for almost every society. It's just a question of who you are willing to treat decently. And for most socialist movements, historically, women have not have not counted. Socialist men have not thought that behaving decently to everyone, you know, it's liberty, egalite, fraternite, you know,
exactly.
It's a brotherhood. So it doesn't surprise me at all to see Orwell as, you know, hopefully he was decent to all of his fellow brother soldiers on the battlefield, but the fact that he wasn't decent to his wife, that he had a sexual double standard. I mean, that's the legacy of the socialist movement, and it has not done enough to reckon with that.
100%. Thank you so much for saying that. Yes, absolutely. And it's very much like, if you look at the political coverage, the foreign affairs coverage, the national security coverage in America, certainly leading in the years leading up to Trump coming to power, the vast majority of the voices platformed across media, especially cable news and the Sunday shows, were men. Something like 75, 78%, some massive, massive number. So it's not a surprise that we ended up with Trump, because women's voices and warnings were being sidelined until we finally just had enough, and the Me Too movement, you know, outed some fools that finally needed to be outed, and allowed the Epstein victims to morph, to come forward, giving them like a cultural shield of these of women voices. And so, yeah, we're in a reckoning that's long overdue, and it has ups and downs. Like, it needs to come back. And I don't think Orwell fans should be threatened, and yeah, Orwell scholars should be afraid, because so many of them overlooked Eileen for so long and just thought that Orwell came out fully formed of Zeus's head, like Athena, like, you know. And I think it's just, it does all of us a service to be centered on the human being and resist the sainthood. Because how else are we going to live up to that? How else are we going to continue the legacy of fighting for the truth and being decent human beings?
Yeah, and this is, it's so important that we do neither. So I have this formulation. Nietzsche says, you know, you can have sort of monumental history in which you just use someone as an exemplar and just try and imitate them, or you can have critical history in which you evaluate them carefully and honestly. But if you do that, literally every person fails the test. So Nietzsche ultimately doesn't really resolve this. But the fact of the matter is, no one is worthy of monumental history. No one can survive critical history. We have to practice both together in some way. Otherwise, the past will become either nothing but saints or nothing but villains. And that's not helping us. Pretending Orwell was, you know, the most decent man who ever lived is not gonna help us understand Orwell. It's not gonna help us use his books. Pretending that Orwell was some sort of inhuman monster who we can safely ignore because he mistreated his wife and other women, that's not going to help us either. Reckoning carefully with who Orwell was, why he was the way he was. I mean, another famous reading of Orwell is that the figure that Orwell empathizes with in 1984 is O'Brien. Is the torturer. The Orwell usually writes a figure like himself in the books, and usually it's pretty obvious who he is, and everyone, you know, gets wrong, I think. This reading comes from Richard Rorty, among others. Everyone gets wrong who he is in 1984. The man, the torturer, may look like his enemy, but the pleasures of hurting someone else, of righteousness, of being right and punishing, those were Orwell's thoughts and feelings. If he weren't at least partially a monster, we couldn't have 1984.
Absolutely. I mean, that's why he calls it the Ministry of Love, the most terrifying of the ministries. And yeah, it's fascinating to see, like I said, art is a collage. So to see all like the little glimpses, little chapters of his life come together in his art, like the room that he worked in at the BBC, I think it was the conference room, was room 101. That was the torture chamber room.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's, I want to talk about Eileen, because she had a brother who you meet in Mrs. Orwell, who's extremely handsome, like Hollywood leading man good looks, and was a renowned chest surgeon. Ironically, I mean, obviously tuberculosis was the big thing. Everyone's getting tuberculosis. And so Orwell suffered from that. And Eileen's brother, Eric, was a specialist and was trying to find a cure because his father had been lost to TB. And so that was how Eileen was able to call up her brother frantically and say, you know, Eric, my Eric, George Orwell, is coughing up blood, hurry, quick, quick. And her brother was able to intervene and help him. And I bring up her brother because he was her rock. He was the one who would drop everything for her in the middle of the night to help her no matter where she was. Like, he would be by her side, and he believed in her and loved her and was so protective of her. And he was the exact opposite of her husband in every way. And what ends up happening, as we see in the script, is that he goes off to fight in Dunkirk. And he never comes back. And there are the Orwells in London during the Blitz. Their building gets bombed. London is rubble. People's clothes are flying around in the wind, on the street, in the trees. And, you know, the British stiff upper lip, everyone's just trying to get through it. And she's living this time in such dark grief and mourning. Like, the reports are that she was practically like just comatose, just not there anymore. And I just think about that so much because the world was ending. They had no idea that they were going to have D-Day and this heroic liberation of Europe and the end of the war. It seemed completely unthinkable then. And despite all that, Eileen and Eric Blair continued creating, continued writing. They fought rejection and censorship to finally get Animal Farm out into the world. And I think that is the message for all of us right now, as beaten down and tired as we are today, our nervous systems under attack deliberately by the oligarchy, by oligarch consolidation of media, by weaponization of every single social media platform of, you know, all ran by major Trump donors. Our nervous systems are deliberately under attack to demoralize us and make us think that there's no future left, and just to submit and surrender and just normalize everything that's happening to us. And I think the message of Eileen and Eric Blair, the message of George Orwell being a band name, is this fact that being defiant is its own victory.
Yeah, I could not agree more. And to go back to where you begin the book with the idea of the pen is the mightier of the sword, and, you know, to bring the tankies up again. So I'm working on a piece on Marx right now, and Marx is very clear that ideas don't matter except as they underlie, are driven by historical materialism, by which he means, you know, physical reality, by which he means economics. He says philosophy doesn't matter, and he says art doesn't matter. All that matters is who holds the means of production. And he contradicts himself in other places. Marx contains multitudes, as we all do. But reading that line by Marx yesterday morning, where he says aesthetics and philosophy don't matter, and then reading your graphic novel with that statement by Eileen at the beginning that says art is the thing that galvanizes us and changes the world, I just thought, I know which side I am on. I am on the side where art matters. I'm on the side where ideas matter. I'm on the side where individual people can, will, and should fight to make the world a better place. And I mean, Eric Blair was too, but with plenty of reservations and, let's say, problematic behaviors. It seems that of the two of them, the one who was most resolute in that stance was Eileen, and this is a figure who I knew almost nothing about before your book. So thank you. Thank you so much for writing it.
My pleasure. And I think that attitude that art doesn't matter is a very privileged one. Yeah. Because for oppressed groups like the Irish, sometimes all they had was their art to fight back and make sense of what was happening to them and process their trauma and grief and to choose to keep going and to memorialize their heroes that had been killed. Art is a major tool of resistance because sometimes that's all we have left. And I have to tell you, speaking as a Ukrainian American, people were surprised that Ukraine stood a chance. Like, we were told by US intelligence and all the fanciest think tank people in the world that Ukraine would get occupied and destroyed in 3 days. And ironically, Trump is now saying that his conquest of Iran is taking 3 days, like, you know, using Putin's own language, using the Russians' own language. And the reason why I did a podcast on Gaslit Nation with some other Ukraine experts saying Ukraine's going to fight and Russia's about to find out was because I knew Ukrainian history and Ukrainian national identity, the sense of we are Ukraine, we are a separate people, a separate country, separate land, a separate language, separate history, a separate culture, existed for centuries through Ukraine's artists. And I cannot tell you how extremely powerful and potent that is as a force of their survival, their independence, and what is driving them today. There were leading poets across Ukraine who used poetry as a coded subversive language or a flat out like punch to the face of the Russian Empire. I'm talking about like the eco-fascist anarchist Lesya Ukrainka, who wrote an amazing poem called The Forest Song, of like a forest spirit that sets a whole village on fire and says something like, you can't kill me, I'll live forever, I never die. Like, it's like, you know, it's so defiant. And the artists were, generation after generation, Ukraine's artists would provide the people that were oppressed with a language on how to keep going, how to be defiant, how to take dignity and pride in yourself as a human being. And that's where Ukraine's liberation movements grew out of. And so generation after generation, the Russians, the Soviets kept imprisoning and targeting and killing the artists over and over again, and it wouldn't stop. And Ukrainians just kept reacting to that by re-releasing their work, performing and organizing their plays, re-releasing their films, and just turning their grief, their rage, and their defiance into massive art festivals. That is what the Euromaidan popular uprising of 2014 was, which drove that Trumpian Ukrainian dictator Viktor Yanukovych out of town to Russia, where he's been exiled ever since. It was an art festival. And the corrupt regime backed by Russian special forces fired on the people, fired on the protesters, killed about 100. These were protesters that set up libraries. They had a stage where music was going all day to keep people dancing in the Arctic freezing cold. They had, I have friends, two musician friends that met and fell in love and now have their own family. And they toured the world performing a folk rock opera about their experience, about what it was like. And so I can't stress enough that when everything else is stripped away from us, using the power of our voice is resistance. And so Marx does make a point that we have to eventually reach the part of owning political power, owning the means of production. Yes, but you don't get there without reminding people of their power and their human dignity. And that is what art and philosophy do first and foremost.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, to bring it back to Eileen, you definitely didn't have to tell the Irish people that art matters. I think that was pretty well established. Look, this has been fantastic. We've been talking for about 40 minutes. The only thing I really have left to say, well, two things is, one, everyone should read this book. And two, is there anything else you would like to say before we go?
No, thank you so much for having me here. And I'm so honored. I'm so honored. This is my first interview for Mrs. Orwell. And if you are in New York City on April 13, come to Powerhouse Books Arena in Dumbo, Brooklyn. Enjoy the beautiful Brooklyn Bridge and come out to the book launch event that we're having. I'm very excited and I look forward to meeting you there, hopefully.
All right. I'll try and get the word out about that. Thank you. Thank you so much. Such a pleasure.
Thank you.